Stay tuned. Coming up on the local news hour this morning, I'll be checking in with Summit County Manager Tom Fisher, taking a look at the agenda for Wednesday's county meeting. Later on, National Ski Areas Association Director of Risk and Regulatory Affairs Dave Bird has the latest about how the ski industry is responding to the Trump administration's decision to stop all foreign employment through the end of the year. Finally, Park City Planning Director Bruce Erickson with details about tomorrow's meeting. That includes a site visit by the Planning Commission to the base of Park City Mountain Resort to get a sense of what is being proposed. Well, taking a look at some local news now, the Summit County Health Board heard yesterday that a number of Eastside businesses feel that they are seriously hurting that due to the county's mandatory mask order, and they say that the county is not listening to them. KPCW's Rick Bruff has more about that.
During a brief conversation in the board's electronic meeting, board member Chris Ewer, a South Summit resident, said he's heard some area business owners say they're being treated, quote, like a kicking post. Ewer recalled visiting with a local restaurant owner when the news about the mask order came down.
The first comment out of his mouth was, "This county is trying to put me out of business." The business owners over here feel that Summit County is not linked to them. Right now is their busy time of the year. It's not during the ski season. It's right now. And all these regulations keep coming into place and all that. And it's like this owner told me, says, "My customers do not wear masks." He says, I require my employees to wear masks, but my customers do not wear masks. It's just the demographic area over here that they do not wear masks. And if they have to wear masks, they're not going to come in and patronize me.
He said the local restaurant tried to follow the COVID restrictions, such as social distancing.
At least the ones I've eaten at, you don't even really interact with them anymore. You just sit down and order off of your phone and go from there.
You said the county should communicate better with the East Side about any further developments. County Health Director Rich Bullo said Ewer had a point and noted he had apologized to several mayors after the mask order was announced. But Bullo told the board that the masks are essential to manage the spread of the coronavirus and to avoid a situation where businesses have to go back to an orange or a red emergency status.
I can say till I'm blue in the face that one of the reasons masks is important is to protect when dinner and you were talking with the business owner. By not having customers come in with masks, he is putting his employees at risk. And that is what is driving the decision. But that conversation, you're spot on. It needs to occur at a different level. We've recognized that and we are working on doing better. In fact, we've got a Council of Governments meeting coming up where we're going to talk with the mayor specifically about that, about communications, about the orders that we've issued, how they impact the East Side.
Summit County Health Director Rich Bullo. For KPCW, I'm Rick Bruff.
It's 8:11 now. Good morning. The Summit County Council meets Wednesday starting at 1:15 with a site visit to the Silver Creek Village Center, that before heading into a closed session and then reopening electronically at 4 o'clock. On the phone with a preview, I have Summit County Manager Tom Fisher. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Leslie.
First, any reaction to the criticism of the county's COVID policy? First, from last week's comments by Todd Fulmer, and then kind of the angst of Eastside restaurant owners reported by Chris Ewer?
Well, I think, we have a situation where, we've got a pandemic that's working its way through globally. We're seeing rising caseloads all over the country. Utah is unfortunately part of the leadership of that in the United States in caseload. We have to do something locally in order to react to this. We know not everybody's going to agree with that. It's very clear within the debate in the United States, about what should be done or what should not be done. But, we're following very sound advice, both from the CDC and from the state leadership about this. We've conferred with state leadership on the solutions that we've put in place. In fact, have gotten those approved. And so we're going to continue on that track until we feel that there's a different track to be taken. And I know that there's differences of opinion within the county about that. and those can be expressed. We're going to and we'll take those into account. But I think the decisions that have been made so far are very sound.
So what I'm hearing is that there could be different areas of the county that don't have to wear masks, or they're not mandatory?
Well, I mean, certainly that has been discussed. I don't think that the county council, the health director, or myself have considered breaking up the county into different zones yet for that. The evidence doesn't support doing that at this point. If at some point the health director brings concept to the group, discuss because of data and what the data is showing, I'm sure that will be considered.
Rich Bulla said that this would be discussed in the next Council of Governments meeting. Do you know when that will be?
Well, we actually have a special Council of Governments meeting scheduled for this evening. I don't know if that's going to be discussed this evening or not, but we also have one coming up within the next month. I don't know the exact date that we would put something like that on the agenda.
All right. So what was the special meeting called for?
The special meeting was just called to follow up with the current order that was put in place. It was done very quickly, and the council and the mayors wanted to discuss that publicly. And then we're going to follow that up with a short item, just making sure everybody is clear and working on the CARES Act funding that is coming to being allocated to the cities and the counties.
All right. Looking at the agenda, the county council making a site visit to the Silver Creek Village. So I know it's a pain getting into the weeds on this, but there's an interesting clash of perspective. Some council members are concerned that the proposal will cluster affordable units and segregate them out onto the outer edge of the project. Kind of that's where those people live. Scott Loomis and the developer, though, Matt Lowe, said they need to do it on this particular site because this is where they can get the low income tax credit. So what does the council want to learn by going to the site?
Well, I think if you, in reading through the staff report that was included last week in that agenda item as it was heard, you know, there's other things, there's different things being asked for in a development agreement change. And some of that has to do with height, some of that has to do with setbacks. And then, of course, there's the issue of really the concept of the original development was that the higher buildings were supposed to be towards the center of the development, and then that got feathered out towards the edge of the development to lower scale buildings. This property, this parcel that's being proposed is right on the outer edge of the eastern side of the Silver Creek development, kind of in the area of the park for Silver Creek, and then bounded on one side by the property that the sewer treatment plant occupies. So, you know, those heights might be an issue, and I think that's one of the things that the council would like to see is kind of the context of that parcel in relation to the rest of the development. And, you know, I'm not sure how that's going to inform them on the whole integration issue of affordable housing into the development, but they'll certainly see where some of the current workforce or attainable affordable housing is being built as it's being developed right now, and see where those parcels are in relation to the one that's being discussed.
All right. How long has it been since the council members have all seen each other in person?
In person, it's been quite a while. I mean, really, we started our electronic meetings in March as a result of the pandemic. So it will be the first time since we started that we've all been in one place. We've seen each other very randomly in other types of meetings, but not all together.
All right, let's say at 4 o'clock, then the council members head home and we'll meet electronically with a review of the Utah special session. Your staff reports that the county didn't get hurt too much on Capitol Hill during the last special session. So how did we get hurt?
Well, I don't think we really got hurt at all. I think probably part of that, you know, sometimes we characterize legislative sessions by things that hurt us or help us, kind of a common way of looking at it. But You know, really, the legislature spent most of its time dealing with larger pandemic statewide issues, as well as their own budget. That was the two big themes of the this last special legislative session. But there's always things that we've got to keep our eyes on. There was an annexation bill that was working its way through that didn't apply to anything specifically in Summit County. But, you know, you never know what can get slipped into legislation at the last minute. So we try to work through our through UAC and some of the affiliate groups with the Utah Associations of Counties to make sure that counties are well served in this.
The county was unsuccessful with the proposal to allow sales taxes like TRT and RAP to be used for COVID-related needs. So what happened to that proposal?
Well, it's still out there. UAC and the legislature didn't pursue that as part of this last legislative session. They didn't do much at all with revenues in that regard. They did in their first session, and it didn't make it to the final cut. The bill that it was included in was not adopted. But they still plan on having another special session before the end of the year, at least one. And I believe that's still an issue that will get taken up.
All right. Let's see. What about regulations on how electronic meetings are conducted? What happened there?
Yeah. So really what it changed was that the chair of whoever leads the group, whether it be a city or a county in whatever form of government they have or special district or other form of subdivision, they don't have to have an anchor location if the chair makes a determination that that's not necessary. And the chair is allowed to make that determination for a 30-day period. We have maintained an anchor location throughout in accordance with the legislation that has been in place since the beginning of the pandemic. And I have not discussed yet with Councilmember Clyde whether he wants to change that.
And there was also a bill regarding public safety, that if a public safety worker thinks that an individual has exposed them to COVID, they can get a warrant to force the individual to be tested?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a lot of different things that especially interaction between law enforcement and the public in relation to the pandemic that are probably being considered. I'm not familiar completely with that legislation. I would have to defer to the sheriff on that and his interpretation.
All right. Regarding the budget, it sounds like the county got lost a chance to get some money for public defenders. How?
Well, I mean, you know, as part of the overall budget discussion at the state level, they had to find places to find cuts, just as we had to do within our own budget leading to April. And that's one of the places that they looked. They had been granting funds to local governments, counties, or coalitions of counties for indigent defense. The grant levels got reduced. So that's a place where we'll have to react to that within our budget process for the next year.
All right. Then at 6 o'clock, a public hearing on the East County Code regarding livestock fencing. You and I have talked about this before, and again, it may stir interest from ranch owners. It sounds like this means that the code would follow the state, and it's more of a fencing approach. Basically, it's the burden of the owner to keep his or her livestock from getting out.
Yeah, that's correct. And you know, we're not exactly sure how we got to a different place on this over time. But it, from the standpoint of how the bulk of the state handles it, it makes a lot of sense for us to, and that's what staff, both from the attorney's office and the planning department, are suggesting based on some public comments that the county council has received in the past from some landowners, livestock owners in the county, that following state law would make more sense. So that's the way the Snyderville Basin Code reads right now. So really, we're just bringing the East County Code in with the rest of the county, and then in line with state law.
All right, just a couple of other questions off the agenda. The transit system, can you talk a little bit about how that's doing these days? I mean, have you ridden the bus at all?
I have ridden the bus, I've ridden the bus, I think, twice since the whole issue of COVID-19 has started. I haven't gone a whole lot of places. When I'm in the county, I'm either on my bike for some recreation, I'm out running, or I transit back and forth to Colville for work when I do that. Otherwise, I've been in my house telecommuting. But I have had a couple of meetings in Park City that I've parked at the Kimball Junction Transit Center and then taken the Electric Express into the MARSAC building. It's still a great way to get around. They're certainly following the mask order, and patrons are asked to follow that mask order as well. They are encouraging distancing on the bus as much as possible. That has been able to happen just because we haven't had a lot of ridership. I think we're starting to see that ridership go up as more people are back to work, because there are a lot of people that are dependent on that bus system for getting back and forth to work. And so we have reduced services to kind of react to both a downturn in revenue, but also because ridership has been lower. But we're looking at that every day to see at what point and what triggers we would push that service back up and provide more as the workforce needs it.
All right. So that's a decision being made between Park City and Summit County?
Absolutely.
I also just wanted to follow up with the complaint that you heard a few weeks ago about 5G wireless. Will the council be scheduling a work session, including a 5G business person as part of that?
Yeah, I haven't gotten any further direction on that. And it's one I probably need to follow up with Doug Clyde on. I think the where we left it and where the council left it was really with the attorney's office to help the council understand really, what are the parameters of regulation around that type of service, because it is very it's reserved for the federal government really to regulate a lot of that stuff. So we're waiting back to hear from the attorney's office on that, and I'm sure we'll be scheduling something for the council to hear very soon.
Okay. Anything else you wanted to mention, Tom?
No, I've got today. Let's stay safe, to stay open, and keep ourselves masked while we're in businesses and out in public.
All right. Tom Fisher, Summit County Manager, thanks for your time this morning. Good morning. Well, on June 22nd, President Trump signed a proclamation extending the ban on several immigration visas, including the J-1 cultural exchange and the H-2B temporary work visas, both of which are potential employees for our nation's ski resorts. Last week, the National Skiers Association, or NSAA, moderated a webinar about how the ski industry moves forward with the restrictions on foreign employee visas. On the phone, I have David Byrd, the Director of Risk and Regulatory Affairs for the NSAA. He moderated that discussion last week. Good morning, and thanks for joining us, Dave.
Thanks for having me, Leslie.
So how big of an impact will this be on the ski industry, or do we even know that?
Well, I think it's going to have a significant impact. And I recognize for your listeners, it's a bit surprising because we have elevated unemployment due to COVID right now. The Federal Reserve Chairman has said by the end of the year, unemployment is going to be around 9%. But for us, with our 470 ski areas across 37 states, we're located in rural, remote communities. We hire any American, any local who wants a job, and we still have a significant number of unfilled positions. So we're going to be working hard with the administration, with members of Congress, to try and make a very strong argument that economically we need to be fully staffed at our ski areas and at the surrounding retailers, hotels, restaurants, the various ski rental shops, so that we can open come December 1st or say November around Thanksgiving, when a lot of skiers try to open. And that's really critical, because if you think about it, because our sport is outside, because we're skiing on hundreds and thousands of acres at ski areas, We really are the one sector of the economy as a sport and as outdoor recreation that can open safely. And so we are going to be making an economic argument to the administration to say, you're going to need to relax this proclamation so that we can have some access to J-1 visa students who come up from the Southern Hemisphere during their college break. As you noted, it is a cultural and diplomacy program. So we're going to be making that argument very strongly with members of the Utah Coalition who are supportive of our arguments and of our efforts, and with members of Congress in the ski states where we utilize this program. Believe it or not, we utilize this program in smaller ski areas in Tennessee, in North Carolina, in Wisconsin, in Minnesota, not just the big Western destination ski areas like Telluride or Mammoth or Crested Butte or Powder Mountain, Utah, which all use the program.
Yeah. So do we have any idea of the number of visa holders who work at ski resorts?
Well, we certainly have numbers that were pre-COVID. For J-1s, we were using close to 8,000 across the industry. That number is obviously going to be cut significantly. Maybe we'll use 4,000 this coming season of higher unemployment. But we still need them. We did a survey this year. Again, it was pre-COVID, but we asked ski areas across the country how many positions did they have that went unfilled because they could not find labor. And the average ski area said they had 44 positions that they could not hire someone to take. Granted, that's pre-COVID, but we also know, again, and it's part and parcel of our locations in rural areas and remote areas, that Americans are not going to relocate, like President Trump likes to argue, for a five-month job in a community with significantly higher housing costs. Those days, in part due to what we saw with the loss of housing due to Airbnb and VRBO in communities, those days of people taking a job, a ski bum taking a job for 5 or 6 months, those are long gone. And for our ski areas to open safely, we're going to need a surprising different staffing model because of COVID. Think of your food and beverage operations where we may have to staff that out completely differently to avoid amassing people inside at crowded food halls and buffets and things like we've traditionally done. So think of chairlift lines and queues like that. We're going to have to social distance. That's going to require more staffing. Housekeeping is going to require more staffing because of the additional safety protocols. But I think Congress and the administration are going to listen to us very closely, again, because I'm a strong believer that, and we saw this, Leslie, when we had a few ski areas like Mount Bachelor and Timberline in Oregon, a basin in Colorado, been for a few weeks in May. And there was such enormous demand to try and get some of those handful of limited reservations to go skiing. We know that's going to be true come Thanksgiving, early December. People want to get out. They want to recreate. It's not like a huge concert in a concert hall. It's an outdoor activity that can be done safely, and we're already a sport that is accustomed to wearing masks and gloves.
Yeah. Given what we have right now, though, I mean, we've got borders that are closed. So, I mean, is this really even going to be an issue? I mean, especially traveling to a place where the coronavirus has been the deadliest here in the States. Who wants to come here?
Well, I think there is interest. We have been talking with a lot of our sponsored folks in the Southern Hemisphere. They're hearing there's continued interest to come here from the J-1 visa student exchange side. However, in terms of interest from guests coming to U.S. ski areas, we anticipate there's going to be a drop in international tourism. And so a number of our marketing programs, both at the individual resort level and at the state marketing and tourism office level, we're really focusing on the drive-to market For example, Ski Utah did a very comprehensive survey and found that folks from as far away as San Francisco, Phoenix, LA, Boise, and Las Vegas are very willing to drive 700 miles to come skiing at Deer Valley or Snowbird or Park City. So we know there's going to be demand. We know there may be less air travel, but we're still going to need significant staffing, not just from the 90% of people we hire locally in our rural communities, but supplemented by programs like the J-1 visa program.
Explain, if you can, the difference then between the two types of visas, and is one used more by the resorts than the other?
Absolutely. So we use two visas. The J-1 visa program is a college student program. It's designed as a cultural and diplomacy program created back in the 60s. those come up on their college break. Their winter break, or their summer break, is our winter season, so it aligns nicely. The other program we use is the H-2B visa, and that's a much more flexible visa, but we were quite surprised that the Trump administration included that visa in this proclamation, because that is the only visa of all the non-immigrant work visa programs, and there are a bunch of them, that requires employers to prove first that they tried to hire Americans, but they were not able to do it, and so they have access then to a limited number of these H-2B visa programs. So that's the difference. The H-2B visa program has a little bit more flexibility because it's not tied to that limited college break program for Southern Hemisphere students, college students. It's a longer program. And for ski areas like destination Western resorts that often can have a 6-7 month season, having that flexibility allows them to utilize H-2Bs much easier than it does the J-1 program, which at most allows for someone to come work in a cultural exchange program for about 4 months.
So how long can people stay? Because it sounded like in the webinar, and again, I didn't listen to the entire thing, but that some of these J-2B just transfer from winter to summer resorts without ever leaving.
Well, what you're referring to is the H-2B program. What can happen is if you come up here, say, to work, and by the way, Leslie, President Trump, his hotels and casinos and golf courses utilize both the J-1 visa and the H-2B program. And I will tell you, those resorts are actually located near major metropolitan areas, unlike most of our ski areas, where they have better access to labor. With the H-2B program, if you come up in May to work at some of the, say, the summer destination, like, say, Cape Cod or the Jersey Shore or Florida or South Carolina beach resorts, they may come up and work in landscaping or golf courses. When they finish up, for example, with a landscaping visa program, that job really ends up typically around October. And so then they can work a few more months transferring over to a winter seasonal employer. But here's the key. These are temporary seasonal worker programs. And we have found consistently in almost every state and in every business sector that because of the temporary and seasonal nature of these jobs, Americans want year-round jobs that provide more stability. They ultimately lead to a path for benefits like healthcare, and seasonal jobs simply don't do that. And so Americans are less and less inclined in taking seasonal jobs. We highlight a poll that came out of the Pew Research Center, very trusted polling company, and found that 60% of Americans said these temporary seasonal jobs that these visa programs help with are jobs that Americans simply don't want to take. So we've got really strong arguments, and I think the administration is going to listen to us with the help of our members of Congress to get a little bit of a relaxation to allow some of these visa holders to come into the country for December 31st, which is when the proclamation ends, and allow them to come in around the time our ski seasons open up, and we need them earlier in December and late November.
Okay, so you are stirring the pot, and at this point, no response or no change?
Well, there's under the proclamation from President Trump, there's a 30-day periodic review at the end of July, and we will be communicating with Secretary of State Pompeo, Department of Labor Secretary Scalia, and others making these arguments, both with formal public comments, but also with letters that we hope ski state congressmen and senators can join on and help us make this argument to the administration.
All right. So you should hear something, you think, maybe by mid-August, huh?
We're hoping so. And that's a key thing, Leslie. The lead to process these applications, we've got to get them processed come late summer and early fall, because what has to happen is these students in the Southern Hemisphere have to go in for an interview with a consulate or an embassy. We'll be up against a challenge with that with COVID, but they have to go in, they have to get fingerprinted, they have to get a special stamp in their passport. So that's going to be another part of our request for a relaxation is, because of the lead processing time that has to be done, say, September, we're asking the administration, particularly the State Department, to provide that ability for those in-person interviews at embassies and consulates in the Southern Hemisphere.
All right. And if visa holders were allowed to come in, then any talk about what kind of quarantine they would have to follow?
Well, that, like everything with COVID, remains fluid. You know, same thing with, you know, whether schools are going to be reopening or colleges. As these are students who are younger and tend to be healthier and tend to be interested in outdoor recreation, you know, we don't know what restrictions or regulations are going to come down. You know, there's been talk of immunity passports or COVID passports. Certainly there'll be testing. I wouldn't be surprised at that. We're seeing that even in professional sports, for example. So, you know, we've got about 3 months to see where that's going to go and how we can do this safely. But I will tell you, the ski area is since we closed early in March, we've had a total economic impact across the ski industry of about $2 billion, more than $2 billion. And for us to be impacted again over the very high revenue time period between mid-December and early January, where many of our skiers make about 30% of their revenue, we would be surprised that the administration would tie our hands because we were so hugely impacted by the early closures in early March. I was at Deer Valley the day it closed, skiing with friends and family. So this is a significant impact. And because the outdoor recreation industry, particularly skiing, can be done outdoors and can be done safely and can be done with social distancing and masks, we think the administration is going to listen very closely to our arguments.
And in terms of the reaction from Utah's delegation, they're, with the exception of Ben McAdams, all support the president.
Absolutely. I'll tell you, Congressman Stewart, Congressman Bishop, Governor Herbert, everyone, Romney, we're working with Lee to explain these challenges. Obviously, the ski industry in Utah is quite significant, not just from the ski resort perspective, but all the surrounding ancillary businesses from hotels, VRBOs, Airbnbs, restaurants, retail shops, et cetera, are significantly impacted by how robust the ski season can be. So we have been especially proud of how the Utah delegation at both the state and the federal level have been supportive of this program.
Okay. Hey, anything else, Dave, you want to mention in the last minute here?
No, I just appreciate you having us on and bringing some light to this.
Okay, we appreciate your time. David Byrd is the Director of Risk and Regulatory Affairs for the National Ski Area of America. Well, with COVID-19 restrictions canceling the formal 4th of July plans across the state, the Wasatch Back had to get creative. Despite the modifications to public fireworks display, officials in Summit and Wasatch County say this year was no busier than years past when it came to responding to fire calls. KPCW's Sean Higgins has more.
It was a 4th of July unlike any in recent memory over the weekend. Park City canceled its traditional parade and fireworks display due to COVID-19 restrictions, and many other towns modified their festivities as well. Local fire officials say many residents throughout the Wasatch Back decided to put on their own fireworks displays instead. Despite the increased number of private firework displays over the holiday, fire officials in both Summit and Wasatch County say they did not see a noticeable increase in fire calls. Park City Fire District Fire Chief Paul Hewitt says firefighters responded to a few smoke scares over the weekend, but the vast majority of calls were for medical reasons, no different than a typical holiday weekend in Park City. He says calls they did receive about smoke were usually just people lighting up a barbecue in their backyard.
I didn't get any calls. I didn't see. Again, in past years, I've seen a lot of illegal fireworks. I live, of course, here in the fire district, and I've seen a lot of illegal fireworks being discharged. I've had to send engines out on those types of calls, and we didn't send one engine out on that type of a call this year. A report of illegal fire being discharged. So again, thanks to the residents for paying attention and being following the guidelines.
Janet Carson of the Wasatch County Fire District adds that although Midway did host their Memorial Hill fireworks display and Touhé put on a show of their own, restrictions were in place to limit people gathering in large groups. She did say there was a noticeable increase in the number of private fireworks shows in Wasatch County, though.
There were a lot of fireworks. I mean, we were down in the valley till nearly 1 o'clock with the engines on standby, and it was unbelievable the fireworks going off, and you know, until after the time they were supposed to cut off. I think there was an increase this year.
Carson adds 4th of July is always one of the busiest days of the year for firefighters. Apart from a few calls from concerned residents in the Heber Valley, the department did not respond to more calls than a typical year, she says. North Summit County Fire spokesman Tyler Rouser says things were not much different up north, with zero fire calls over the weekend for an overall quiet holiday. With 4th of July now over and fire season in Utah in full swing, Park City Fire District Fire Marshal Mike Owens says people still need to be extra careful when it comes to wildfire danger this year.
But as rain stops coming, and now we had these high winds and the temperatures have really increased, now we're getting to the point where we have to be very concerned about the fire danger. Throughout most of the state, things were looking pretty good. In the southern portion of the state, they're pretty dry, and the fire risk is high up there. But where we are, the fire risk is still right at what we would call normal. That's not to say that there won't be any fires, but the likelihood is neither higher or lower than average.
State and federal fire officials reported 18 fireworks-related wildfires were responded to statewide over the weekend, and an outright ban on fireworks across Utah is now in place until the Pioneer Day holiday, starting July 22nd. Sean Higgins, KPCW News.
The Park City Planning Commission will conduct a site walk of the Park City Mountain Resort Base Area parking lot redevelopment area tomorrow. That will be followed by the regular meeting. Starts at 5:30. On the phone with an update, Park City Planning Director Bruce Erickson. Good morning.
Good morning, Leslie.
So the site tour at Park City Mountain is being 3 and 5 for the Planning Commission. I understand that the applicant has sent out notices for people to register for their own tours at either 1 or 2 o'clock. So nobody will be able to tail the Planning Commission and find out what their questions are?
No, that's not quite right. It's an open and public meetings site tour for the Planning Commission at 3 o'clock. The applicant has every right to kind of do their own outreach to the public. I think the difference is that on the Planning Commission walk around, there's no way that we can, you know, take minutes and respond to all the comments. So the Planning Commission is not going to be asking they're going to ask clarifying questions, but they're not going to be asking anything that would relate to the change in the project. So that's the difference, is the applicant is doing their own personal outreach at 1 o'clock and 2 o'clock to the public, and public can do whatever it wants, talking to the applicant then, and then when the Planning Commission gets there, the public is more than welcome to hear the Planning Commission ask questions but we're going to be, we have to be a little bit careful because we can't take minutes for this portion of the meeting.
All right. So if people are interested in joining the PEG team for a socially distant through of the project, they need to RSVP to baseareaproject@gmail.com and indicate what time they prefer, at 1 or 2 o'clock. You're asking the Planning Commission to make a formal determination of whether or not the applicant's application should require a review of the entire master plan and development agreement, or just a look at the existing application. What's changed between last meeting and now?
A couple of conversations that we've been having about how to manage this project and whether this is a substantive change to the master plan that was proposed in 1997. There's two levels of approval in this thing, Leslie. There's the site plan, which was approved in 97, and then there's the development agreement. And so there's some relationship things that we're trying to work through between the ski area and PEG on things like transit and housing and other obligations in the development agreement, while letting PEG move their master plan forward for review by the Planning Commission. So it's very complicated.
It looks
very
like
kind of a distorted approval.
It looks like staff has determined that there are as many as 8 substantive changes, everything from total square feet to setback and height exceptions. So now what?
Well, we just need the Planning Commission to approve that determination, and that'll tell us how we want to move it forward. You know, we may not understand all there is to know about how the development agreement fits together till we come out the other end of the approval process, and what Vail's relationship is going to be, Park City Mountain Resort's relationship is going to be with PEG relative to transit, transportation, operation of the parking lots, summer operations of the parking lots. If there is off-site parking that's required, we don't understand how that's going to work either.
So for the site walk then tomorrow, what will planning commissioners be looking for?
Well, the planning commissioners are just trying to get an understanding of what the project's going to do. The developer is flying some balloons, which you've seen before, on the heights of the buildings. We'll probably be looking at where the intersection locations of the parking garages are on Lowell Avenue. Hopefully we get an opportunity to understand how the sidewalk system will work and what the kind of impacts are on the most adjacent neighborhoods.
All right. The applicant says that they'll show where the 1,200-day skier parking spots will be located, as well as the affordable and workplace housing and the proposed hotel footprint. Have we decided, though, that they need more than the 1,200 that they're currently, that they would be replacing, that they do need that additional 600?
Well, we're trying to work through that model at this point, Leslie. They certainly feel like they do not need the additional 600. But I think that's a commitment from the ski area not to to expand. So the ski area, when the 600 spaces was approved, had a series of ski pods over on Pinecone Ridge, plus some changes in some other lift systems in their master plan. They may or may not be proceeding forward with that. But as everybody knows, the 1,200 parking spaces get filled pretty quickly, and all of a sudden there's 250 spaces full at the high school that we're not real sure how to deal with at this point. Because we don't know if there's a long-term lease there, you know, who's running the transit. Like I say, that's the relationship between Vail, Park City Mountain Resort, and PEG on any transportation from off-site parking. So we need to work all the way through all of that.
All right. Again, the site tour for the Planning Commission happening between 3 and 5. If people want to go through a tour with the PEG team, they can email them, baseareaproject@gmail.com. and sign
That's
up
correct.
For a 1 or 2 o'clock time. The timeline here, it sounds like a vote by the end of October. Is this a Planning Commission decision, or would it go on to City Council?
The master plan approval is a Planning Commission decision. I don't know that I can commit to the October date at this point, given what we're going through at this point.
All right.
So, you know, it's going to be theoretically, it'll be before the end of the year.
During work session, a quarterly commission discussion, including annexation among topics, no staff report here. So what's the discussion that's going to happen?
Well, the Planning Commission just wants to talk amongst themselves about, you know, transportation issues, housing issues, height exceptions, and they want an update on any of the annexations we're moving forward on. So they wanted to have a conversation. There was no reason to write a staff report because this is entirely a commission conversation, and staff is just going to sit there and take notes and try and understand what the commission is doing. I will probably do a preface on this particular section dealing with external growth between the MIDA project over on the Jordan L, potential projects in Hideout, the Silver Creek Junction project, and the Boyer project over by Skull Candy, which could be throwing, you know, a couple, 3,000-4,000 additional units into our marketplace. And I don't know that we have a solution for how we handle parking or that additional number of units into the system. So I'll be prefacing that and say we should probably have a conversation about external growth as well.
Okay. Let's see. Also in work session, commission will consider a new section in the land management code for electric vehicle charging stations and installation requirements. We've talked about this. What's being proposed?
Right now, we're going to continue to talk about it a little bit. But so if you were doing a new single family home or a duplex, you'd be required to put the correct wiring in for an electric vehicle charging station and the conduit, but you would not be required to put the charging station in itself. So it's, if I understand the report, it's a couple hundred dollars, but you're putting in a 220 outlet, which is the same as you would put in for your dryer. And then if you want to do a charging station, you'd have to just plug it into that. You know, on larger projects, the planner has proposed a number of how many EV charging stations need to go into each one of the projects based on the ratio of parking. And the city is doing 100 charging stations already in town. You'll see the three of them up here on the Main Street garage. And there's at least three, maybe six inside of the Main Street garage right now. I think the tricky bit is what level of operation are we asking for? The level one operation takes a long time to charge the car. The level two operation is fairly quick, a couple hours is all it takes. And the level three only takes an hour, hour and a half to give you a full charge. So we're asking for service to work at level two, especially in condos and multifamily housing units, so that more than one person get to a charging unit and not have to wait all night while somebody else charges.
All right. And real quick here, Planning Commission will also consider some land management code amendments replacing the term Master Festival with Special Event. So the Sundance Film Festival and the Kibble Arts Festival in the future will be known as Special Events and wouldn't be required to get a festival license?
Well, we're trying to get, yeah, that's generally correct. We're trying to move planning out of the one-off short-term event management process. Jenny Dearson and her team have got it down pretty well. We're not seeing any particular impact. So it looked like the planning department was just kind of a redundant oversight committee that wasn't really helping Jenny and her team to get the permits done. So we're moving planning department out of the special events process and letting special events do their job.
Okay, I need to leave it there. Bruce, thanks so much for your time this morning.
All right, Leslie, thank you. Bye-bye.
It's Park City Planning Director Bruce Erickson, and the Park City Planning Commission will be meeting on site of the Park City Mountain Resort base area there starting at 3 o'clock tomorrow. They'll be there between 3 and 5, and then moving back for an electronic meeting. That starts at 5:30. If you are interested in joining the applicant's team for a socially distanced walkthrough of the project, you can RSVP to baseareaproject@gmail.com. They're going to be doing two tours, one at 1 o'clock, the other at 2.